Hello, on this week's program we listen back to our conversation with Katie Friedland and Marla K. Shoemaker, authors of the children's book A is for Art Museum. We'll also drop in on an art program for preschoolers at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Susan Lewis takes us to the Penn Museum exhibition Fulfilling a Prophecy, the Past and Present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania. Jason Pfeiffer explores sacred harp singing, a resurgent a cappella tradition that dates back to the early 1800s. And Tom Keels uncovers Philadelphia's history as a brewery town and explores the city's current beer-making renaissance. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
On a recent Sunday morning, a group of preschoolers has been given a quick lesson in gallery etiquette.
And I just want to tell you one very important rule.
You can't touch anything.
Exactly.
And for many, having their first experience interacting with great art. In this instance, Marc Chagall's 1911 Oil on Canvas, Half Past Three, The Poet.
How many ears does our picture have? Look up high.
One.
Well, only one ear? Can you guys grab your ears? We're lucky we have 2 years, huh?
The woman leading this group of toddlers is Katie Friedland, the museum's manager of family and children's programs, who, along with senior curator of education, Marla Shoemaker, has written A is for Art Museum, a new take on the standard ABC book for preschoolers. The book's aim is to enhance the museum-going experience for the very young and their families, and matched with 26 letters of the alphabet are images from the museum's collections, along with questions to engage children with the works. When I spoke with Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker, I first asked Katie how the idea for this interactive book had come about.
I oversee family programs at the museum, and I would notice that a lot of families would come in and have this wonderful experience with us in the building, but then would ask me if there was anything they could take home to, you know, use again, or people would call and say, I'm going to be coming to the museum next week. Is there anything I can use before I come to introduce my children to the artwork? And I started thinking about that it would be so wonderful if we had a book that families could enjoy and could, you know, prepare them for a visit to the museum and who would help them then continue their learning after they left. So that's where the original thought came. And because at the PMA, our family audience, the largest audience is preschoolers, I knew I wanted to do something that, you know, was for that audience, and the alphabet just seemed like a perfect place to start.
And that was where you started. And what then, Marla, was the process of deciding what artworks would represent each letter?
Given that the museum has 250,000 plus objects, it took a long time to pick the 26 images. And it was a process that involved both Katie and me, but also our wonderful director, Ann Darnancourt, who passed away.
And this may well be the last book.
So we are delighted that she played a part. We began by wanting parents and children to know, without saying it, but just by showing it, that museums have all kinds of things inside them, not just paintings. Clothes and furniture and paintings and sculptures and old things and new things and things from other countries and things from today, to really try to represent breadth. You know, my background is I've been at the museum for 35 years, and for 20 of those I was teaching kids every day in the gallery. So I have a lot of experience with what kinds of things capture kids' imaginations at different ages. So finding things that we thought parents and kids could just pore over and talk about all different kinds of things when they looked at them. So it was kind of a long process to pick the 25.
And is there a science? Because I know with preschoolers, they can be either really easy to reach if you get it right, mm-hmm. or completely impossible otherwise. Is there some sort of child psychology, or was there any science behind the images you chose or how you went about it?
Yeah, mainly in the one or two either questions or sentences that we attach to each letter. And that did affect sometimes us deciding to switch out a work of art for another. We wanted to tap into the things kids are good at during the preschool years. Kids are good at moving. So we wanted some suggestions about relating to this work of art physically with your body. My favorite one is for the Modigliani painting, N is for neck. Modigliani is a school of Paris painter from the early 20th century who puts these gorgeous swan-like necks on the woman that he paints. And it's sort of all you ever wanted to say about Modigliani anyway, is neck. And so we ask the children to stretch their neck and, you know, to so and that by stretching the neck, we know, or educational psychologists know, kids notice that long neck more by actually stretching their own neck. So some of the activities have to do with moving their bodies, pose like this dancer, et cetera. We also wanted to use the other thing preschoolers are really good at is imagining and moving from reality into fantasy really, really smoothly. So we ask them when we have an image for, oh, it's for ostrich of a carousel figure that's in the shape of an ostrich. And one of the things we say is, you know, where would you ride? Where would you sit? Which is a looking activity. But the last thing is, and what would you say to this ostrich? You know, tapping into that side of them. And then finally, we want them to be more visually acute and to grow their sense of seeing. And so some questions are look and find questions.
I have to confess that with my own two-year-old, Katie, I sat her on my knee and went to read this book, and she wasn't interested first time around. And then she kept going back to it because the subjects are slightly more oblique than they might normally be in an ABC book, Apple Ball. And it was a deeper process that when we were looking for, I think, Z for Zebra, it's amongst a group of a lot of other animals in a painting of Noah's Ark. And the zebras are there in line, and she had to go and find those. Did you purposefully make it less obvious than might be the case with other such books?
Well, I mean, I wanted to make it, you know, I have a toddler at home as well, and I wanted to make a book. Marla and I both felt that we wanted a book that parents and children would enjoy reading together. So I know that my son loves to point out every ball that he sees, but I also know that that is a little tiresome for me over, you know, over time. And so there are certain books that we have in our own personal collection that I feel like I get a lot out of as we read, and therefore we get a lot out of, you know, as a parent-child unit.
You'll have to give me a list later.
I will, definitely. I could definitely do that. But so I think that, you know, I wanted to choose things that I thought would be interesting, that I would want to expose to my child, that I wanted to help, you know, thinking of my own son, things that, you know, that would help him take his, you know, learning experience to the next level. So, yeah, we were trying to choose a little bit more unusual things.
Philadelphia Museum of Art educators Katie Friedland and Marla Shoemaker, authors of A is for Art Museum, now available on the Temple University Press imprint.
Look up there. What do you see up there?
Flowers. This is a great picture. I'm so glad that you guys got to look at this picture with me today. Give yourself a big round of applause. Thank you for coming. Good
job. You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
According to conventional history, few, if any, Lenape Indians remained in Pennsylvania after the 18th century, most having been killed or driven west by European settlers. However, an exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum tells the story of those who stayed, forming communities whose members hid their Lenape identities, yet managed to continue and pass on their traditions in secret for nearly two centuries. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Fulfilling a Prophecy, the Past and the Present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania.
When University of Pennsylvania anthropology student Abigail Selden was putting together a one-case exhibit about what happened to the Lenape people, she met with the elders of today's Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania and asked them why there was virtually nothing about them in the literature.
Every book I've read says that you don't exist and that you're not in Pennsylvania anymore. And they said, yeah, we know. I said, but you're here. And they said, well, we've been keeping our history a secret for 200 years, so of course it's not in the books.
The Lenape's cautious willingness to share their history was a doorway, opened a crack, into another culture, a natural fit with a museum dedicated to understanding the world's cultural heritage, let alone one in its own backyard. Selden's advisor, anthropology professor Bob Prusell, curator of North America at the Penn Museum, says that while most of the cultures in the museum are presented at a point in the past...
For example, ancient Egypt, we have incredible collections here, but there's not a lot on contemporary Egypt here. So one of the things that we want to do with Native America is to show the continuities and connections between the archaeology, the history, and the contemporary communities.
So what started out as a small student project grew into a museum show covering hundreds of years. Co-curated by Selden, along with Chief Bob Red Hawk Ruth and Shelley DePaul of the Lenape Nation, it took its shape and context from a story handed down through the generations called Prophecy of the Fourth Crow, about, among other things, hiding and returning.
Long ago it was said that a fox will be loosened on the earth. Also, it was said four crows will come.
As the story goes, the first crow flew in harmony with the Creator. The second crow tried to clean the world, but he became sick and died. The third crow saw his dead brother, and he hid. The fourth crow flew the way of harmony again with the Creator. The ending comes full circle.
Caretakers, they will live together on the earth.
As told here, the first crow in the prophecy corresponds to the Lenape before the first contact with Europeans. The second crow represents the period from about 1600 until 1800, when initially peaceful coexistence with William Penn and others deteriorated in subsequent generations. This is starkly illustrated by an enlarged 1764 ad placed by one of William Penn's sons in Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette.
John Penn is offering payment to civilians who capture Delaware or Lenape individuals or who kill them and turn in their scalps as evidence. And the payment for a male over 10 years of age was $134, and for a female, $50. So there was a really clear heritage in Pennsylvania of indiscriminate violence against people of Native American heritage.
By the beginning of the 19th century, remaining Lenape had either fled or gone into hiding. And it is the next 200 years of secrecy, represented by the third crow, that is the driving force of this exhibition. Chief Bob Redhawk says his people found ways to survive.
Whether it was intermarriage, whether it was hiding who you are, you did whatever you could. If you could pass as a white or even as African-American, and this is even during segregation times, we were low men on the totem pole.
Passing as members of other ethnic groups was in some cases made easier because intermarriage was common. Selden says Lenape women, for example, married German farmers and kept connections to their land. Generations of intermarriage eventually created a population with looks as diverse as the larger culture. Children could be blonde and fair-skinned, dark with black hair, and everything in between. Outwardly, they assumed a non-Lenape identity. In the privacy of family gatherings, they continued to practice Lenape traditions and pass down stories. Even outward appearances were full of symbols, as shown in this exhibition on things as ordinary as a kitchen apron with a particular stitch along the bottom, or a wooden fence post with a subtle carving.
Poles like this one were scattered throughout farmland. This has a face on it pretty clearly, but it could just be a signpost.
And what is the face?
It represents Mising, who's the protector of the woodlands.
The importance of secrecy was drummed into the youngest of children, as evidenced by a rag doll in this show.
If you look carefully underneath her hair, which is now pulled to both sides, you can see that there's a second face. And this was a doll that was made for a little girl by her Lenape grandmother in the 1940s. And the woman told the little girl that this doll had the second face and that this represented the little girl's Lenape face and her identity, which she had to keep a secret because she could not tell anybody who she was.
Secrecy, rooted in fear, became part of the culture. But now, perhaps it is indeed the time of the fourth crow. In recent years, more people have begun to openly acknowledge their Lenape heritage, particularly as caretakers of nature. In 2002, the Lenape Nation signed the first Treaty of Brotherhood with churches and other community groups, pledging to support the Lenape cultural education programs and their work for the environment. The chief himself has traveled openly internationally, on tour with his large drum, which for now sits in a gallery at the Penn Museum, along with artifacts and photographs, evidence of children and parents, grandparents and great-grandparents.
These people were living, breathing people, and it's because of their ways of surviving that we're here today, and we're hoping that our children can come in here now and be proud.
It is their story, and it is our story, a rich texture in the national fabric, an important part of what it means to be an American, native or not.
That report was by WRTI's Susan Lewis. Fulfilling a prophecy, the past and present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania is at the University of Pennsylvania Museum through September 13th. In recent years, the tradition of sacred harp music has enjoyed renewed interest throughout the country. Regular sacred harp meetings are held in over 30 states, including all-day gatherings, week-long camps, and national conventions. The music doesn't involve a harp of any kind, but rather features a cappella singing in four-part harmony. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the singing style has been around for centuries and today regularly brings together diverse groups of singers.
On the fourth Thursday of each month, a group of about 30 or 40 people set up dozens of chairs into a square formation and cram into a small building called the A Space, just off of Baltimore Avenue in West Philadelphia. They gather to sing shape note music, also commonly referred to as sacred harp music, a nod to a popular songbook of the same name used by most singers. The book was first published in 1844, but the shape note system associated with sacred harp was invented around 1800. It's a style that was developed so that untrained singers could sight read music without having to understand key signatures. The music is written with shaped notes, triangles, ovals, squares, and diamonds, each notating the intervals from the key pitch. Fascinating as the mechanics of this four shape note system might be, Elizabeth Stokes, the organizer of the monthly West Philadelphia singings, views something else as the primary attraction to sacred harp singing.
Pretty much the essence of what's really special about it is that it's participatory. We're not singing for an audience, we're singing for each other.
This is demonstrated in the arrangement of the singers. Divided into four groups, treble, alto, tenor, and bass, they sit in what's called a hollow square, with a voice part on each side of the square, all facing each other. There's no section for an audience, and there's no one conductor. The singers take turns selecting songs and leading them. While shape note music originated in colonial New England, it gained great popularity in the South and the western frontier of the country during the early 1800s. Over time, the sacred harp style was eclipsed in many areas by the musical norms of Europe, the more conventional arrangements found in the hymn books of most churches today. But traditions of shape note singing were preserved, largely by rural church communities in the South. In more recent decades, people outside of the South have again taken interest in the singing, like the West Philadelphia singers. As newcomers become exposed to the music, Elizabeth Stokes says one thing they often notice about sacred harp gatherings is that the participants sing loudly.
Sometimes not always in key, though we do strive for in key. But, I mean, there are a lot of sayings with sheet note music. One famous one being said that, you know, you'll travel across the country to sing it, but you wouldn't cross the street to hear it. In many ways, a lot of people don't like the sound of shape note music.
In keeping with the original intentions of shape note music, the tradition is not about featuring polished performances by trained singers. Instead, people with little or no musical experience are encouraged to join in. They say if you can talk, you can learn to sing sacred harp. To help everyone of all skill levels stay together, many singers keep the beat by stomping a foot or rhythmically moving a hand up and down. And to aid learning the tune faster, each song commences with first singing through the shaped notes, with the corresponding fa, sol, la, or mi. There are over 500 songs in the Sacred Harp Tune Book. Though the texts of some of the songs are patriotic in nature, most of them have obvious religious themes. Many of the tunes are set to words written by clergymen like Isaac Watts, Charles Wesley, and John Newton. In the view of Anna Mays, a regular of the Philadelphia Sacred Harp group, the lyrics address topics that contemporary culture tends to avoid.
We sing a lot about death, and we sing about pain and sorrow and the traveling along life's journey and kind of what comes after life. We sing about it in a fashion that I think more reflects how those singers in generations before us were looking at those subjects, and we're more willing to maybe take it by the horns than we are today.
For some singers, like Guy Banks, a Levittown, Pennsylvania resident who often drives into Philadelphia for singings, the songs don't always settle well.
It's rather coarse, I would say, but some of it is really beautiful stuff. I may not embrace all of the poetry, but I see the beauty in it.
Banks's appreciation for the poetic nature of the songs and the traditions of sacred harp singing is shared by many. Yet others also find a deep spiritual connection to the songs. It's an expression of worship. Indeed, Anna Mays says there's an ongoing conversation among sacred harp enthusiasts. Is it spiritual music or a folk tradition?
Your answer is going to depend on who you ask.
however one labels it. Sacred Harp singers frequently talk about the joy of being part of an eclectic community, young and old, musically trained and untrained, religious and non-religious. Ted Stokes, who lives over an hour away from Philadelphia and has been singing Sacred Harp for about 15 years, says the regular meetings, conventions, and camps around the country create a special bond among the singers.
150 years ago, people had community in a totally different style than we have accessible today, and this is a return to that tight-knit community. And it transcends local geography anymore with cars, and people take planes to go to singings, you know, just because they want to be with other singers that sing this kind of music and you know, have 50 voices all blending together. And there's just a power that's there. It's hard to put a name on it. Everyone might have a different name, and it's you kind of just have to feel it.
Stokes says not feeling the music is one problem few Sacred Harp singers have.
Some people complain that we get a little too excited and sing too loud, and you're going to wreck your voice, as choral people tell us, you know, and that could be. I try to hold back, but it's hard sometimes not to get carried away.
The Sacred Harp meetings of West Philadelphia have only been going on for about a year, but the group continues to grow. Meanwhile, a handful of other singings regularly take place in the region: Havertown, Lancaster, Reading, and Westchester. While Sacred Harp may have taken root in and been preserved in the rural South over the past century or so, the tradition is now cropping up all over the country, bringing together ensembles of voices through the joy of singing.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Later this month, Philadelphia hosts the two-day Keystone Sacred Harp Convention at the Broad Street Ministry in Center City, Philadelphia. Anyone who has ever attended a local sports event knows that Philadelphians love their beer. But what's less well understood is the role that Philadelphia brewers played in the social and architectural development of the city during the 19th century. Now, WRTI's Tom Keels explores Philadelphia breweries, past and present.
The biggest mausoleums in West Laurel Hill Cemetery in Lower Merion belong to 19th century Philadelphia brewers. Stand in front of the old office, and the largest tombs in sight are two marble temples bearing the names Bergdahl and Poff. Behind the office looms the Betz Mausoleum, a German Baroque fantasy. Although the names Bergdahl, Betz, and Poff are little known today, these brewers were major commercial and community leaders in Victorian Philadelphia, according to Williams College history professor Michael J. Lewis.
Around these breweries, almost all of which were run by Germans, grew up large communities of workers' housing, social institutions, banks, which made these neighborhoods coherent groupings of German culture.
Philadelphia was home to breweries from its birth. When William Penn landed in 1682, beer was already being brewed on Dock Creek. But, says Rich Wagner, president of the Pennsylvania Brewery Historians, Philadelphia did not become a national brewing center until 1840.
John Wagner came from Bavaria, smuggled yeast from his brewery there, somehow got to Philadelphia. His brother-in-law helped him set up a home brewery.
Philadelphia's growing German population and the pure water from its artesian wells made the city a beer lover's paradise. In 1880, over a dozen breweries operated in Brewery Town alone, the district bounded by 30th Street, Oxford Street, 33rd Street, and Girard Avenue. By 1900, beer production had spread throughout the city. Rich Wagner recalls,
"When I was growing up and I would ask the old people, tell me about Brewery Town, and the common response was Philadelphia was one big brewery town. In 1888, there were probably, 96 breweries or 95 breweries in the city."
Many of these breweries operated in sprawling complexes of handsome brick buildings with stone and terracotta trim. Michael Lewis reveals that this uniform look was no coincidence.
Virtually every brewery in Philadelphia was built by one man, and that was Otto Charles Wolfe. And the characteristic look of the Philadelphia brewery, which is brick relieved with granite and terracotta trim, it tends to be a proud and haughty tower with a bold outline. This is the creation of Otto Wolfe.
Wolfe designed most of Philadelphia's major breweries, including Bergner and Engel, Poff, and Schmidt. But his masterpiece was the Bergdahl Brewing Company, built in the 1880s at 28th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. Michael Lewis thinks that Wolf's design was influenced by Frank Furness, the leading architect of the period.
To my eye, it's the best example of Otto Wolf trying to do what Furness did with his banks, to create some lumbering, top-heavy, cheeky, arrogant proclamation of identity. The way the Central Bay corbels out reprises what Furness did at the Provident Life and Trust Bank. This is by far the most adventuresome brewery that Wolf ever designed.
Today, these elegant structures have been transformed into condos. Another Otto Wolf creation, the former Class and Nakod Brewery at 10th Street and Montgomery Avenue, now serves as a Temple University dormitory and office center. Rich Wagner explains that the survival of the entire Class and Nakod complex is a unique story.
What's interesting about this is it's a complete brewery complex. You had the large building over here, which would have housed the brew house, and then the vast fermenting and aging cellars. And then the next to the stable and garage would have been the bottling shop. And then behind this is where you see the smokestack would have been where you had the boiler house.
For Wagner, the beauty and solidity of brewery buildings is a testament to their owners' pride and faith in their own future.
These were their industrial castles, and they intended them to be here forever.
But this seemingly permanent world evaporated between 1910 and 1920, when it was hit by the double whammy of anti-German sentiment during World War I and the economic devastation of Prohibition, says Michael Lewis.
So in the scheme of Philadelphia history, it's a very short reign of power these brewers enjoy.
After Prohibition began in 1920, Brewery Town became a ghost town. While a few brewers reopened after Prohibition was repealed in 1933, Philadelphia was no longer a great beer town. Some abandoned factories still dominate their neighborhoods, like the Ortley Brewery at American and Poplar Streets, or the Poth Plant at Jefferson and 31st Streets. Others have been demolished, like the giant Schmitz Complex at 2nd and Girard, now an empty field. Berwich Wagner believes that Philadelphia is entering a beer renaissance.
We have Yards just opened a new brewery, Philadelphia Brewing Company. We have Notting Head Brewery and Restaurant. We have Manioc Brewery and Restaurant. And we have Triumph Brewery. Oh, I didn't mention Dock Street. There's a new brewery out in West Philly.
At the intersection of Frankfort Avenue and York Street in Kensington stands the Weisbrod and Hess Brewery, designed by A.C. Wagner in the 1880s. Today, this Victorian complex is alive with the sound of delivery trucks and the smell of fresh hops. Since 2001, the brewery has housed the Philadelphia Brewing Company. Nancy Barton, co-owner of the company, found that recycling the 19th-century structures for a 21st-century business was easier than expected.
We bought this building in May of 2001, and it needed a lot of cosmetic work. But because the building was built as a brewery, structurally, it was perfect. It's brick and concrete, and you know it was built strong and built to last.
She says she's felt great satisfaction in restoring the old brewery to its original purpose.
We bought the building, and all the windows were concreted up and boarded up, and it looked abandoned. So it is very rewarding and satisfying to look back and see what we've done to it and kind of regenerated it and put new life into it.
While Philadelphia may have far fewer breweries today than it had at its peak, it is still possible to appreciate the architectural beauty of its survivors. And it's still possible to relax with a tall, cool pint of a local brew, whether it's Philadelphia Pale Ale, Row House Red, or even Walt Witt.
WRTI's Tom Keels. And that's it for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.